Today's class will be given by His Grace Mahavishnu Prabhu on the topic Srimad Bhagavatam 4.6.45. Hare Krishna Prabhuji, Dandavas Pranam, you are there Prabhuji.
Hare Krishna, this is Mahavishnu from Massachusetts. Please accept my
Hare Krishna Prabhuji.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji, please accept our humble obeisances of Gorishta Prabhupada and our Gorishta Guru Maharaj. Thank you so much, Prabhuji, for giving your valuable time and your association in this conference call. You can please take over, Prabhuji. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. Om Jnanatimirandasya Jnananjana Salakaya Chakshuramilitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Nama Om Vishnu Padhaya Krishna Krishthaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedhanta Swaminiti Namina Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyabhadi Paschatya Deshitharine Manjakalpatarubhyascha Kripasandibhyayevacha Patithanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Yadvaita Gadadhara Srivasari Gauru Bhaktivinda. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 6, Text Number 45. I believe that is the correct verse. Sankarmanam mangala mangalaram Katyusvalokam tanishasvaparam va Amangalanam chakshamishra ubharam Viparyaya kena tureva kasyachit. Pardon me. O most auspicious Lord, you have ordained the heavenly planets, the spiritual Vaikuntha planets, and the impersonal Brahman sphere as the respective destinations of the performers of auspicious activities. Similarly, for others who are miscreants, you have destined different kinds of hells, which are horrible and ghastly. Yet sometimes it is found that their destinations are just the opposite. It is very difficult to ascertain the cause of this. Reported by ISKCON founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is called the Supreme Will. It is by the Supreme Will that everything is happening. It is said, therefore, that not a blade of grass moves without the Supreme Will. Generally, it is prescribed that performers of pious activities are promoted to the higher planetary systems. Devotees are promoted to the Vaikunthas, or spiritual worlds, and impersonal speculators are promoted to the impersonal Brahman effulgence. But it sometimes so happens that a miscreant, like Ajamili, is immediately promoted to the Vaikuntha simply by chanting the name of Narayana. Although when Ajamil uttered this vibration, he intended to call his son Narayana. Lord Narayana took it seriously and immediately gave him promotion to Vaikuntha. Despite his background, which was full of sinful activities. Similarly, King Daksha was always engaged in the pious activities of performing sacrifices. Yet, simply because of creating a little misunderstanding with Lord Shiva, he was severely taken to task. The conclusion is, therefore, that the Supreme Will is the ultimate judgment. No one can argue upon this. A pure devotee therefore submits in all circumstances to the supreme will of the Lord. Accepting it is all auspicious. That is from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 14, Text Number 8. The purport of this verse is that when a devotee is in a calamitous condition, he takes it as a benediction of the Supreme Lord and takes responsibility himself for his past misdeeds. In such a condition, he offers still more devotional service and is not disturbed. One who lives in such a disposition of mind, engaged in devotional service, is the most eligible candidate for promotion to the spiritual world. In other words, such a devotee's claim for promotion to the spiritual world is assured in all circumstances. A very, very interesting verse, and Prabhupada's explanation as well. There is no telling why personalities end up either in hell or in heaven or promoted directly to Vaikuntha or not. That is not for ourselves to ascertain. Krishna's reasoning, Krishna's purposes, Krishna's judgment is beyond our understanding. Now, of course, we understand this, we accept this theoretically. That's the easy part. Accepting it theoretically is easy, but is also bewildering, because we may try so hard to achieve some kind of agyata sukriti or some kind of sukriti, and then someone obtains some agyata sukriti, some unknowing pious activity, and they seem to get more favorable outcomes. And it's hard for us to understand this. Sometimes can be so. But the key point that we have to recognize and to understand, and that is brought up by Srila Prabhupada in this purport, is the fact that Krishna's judgment on these issues is always to our benefit. Right? Krishna, remember Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, where he tells Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, please, my dear Arjuna, declare it boldly that my devotees never perish. Because sometimes it may seem that devotees do perish. Sometimes it may seem that devotees do suffer. Sometimes it seems that devotees do have calamitous situations, and it's hard for us to understand. But the fact of the matter is that Krishna's devotees never perish. What we see externally may be bewildering. We may see devotees going through some various illnesses, various accidents. We wonder, why is Krishna doing this? Because we only recognize what's on the surface. We can only tell what's on the surface. The story of that devotee's trajectory towards Krishna is unknown to us. The story of that journey, of that person's path towards Krishna, is unknown to us, as well as our own. We do not know where we stand in our devotional service to Krishna, in the sense that, I mean, we know we have so much impurities to overcome. We know that we have so many anarthas, right? But how can we possibly say, how can we possibly know when Krishna will show us extra mercy? So as Prabhupada mentions in the purport, it behooves us to simply engage in devotional service to the best of our ability. It behooves us to continue to engage in our devotional service without consideration as to whether or not I am developing spiritually or not, without being concerned with what is the what am I accumulating in my spiritual bank account. We are required to serve. We chant Hare Krishna. We chant our rounds every day. Why? Why do we chant our rounds every day? We know by the instruction of Srila Prabhupada, that the chanting of our round is asking, my dear energy of the Lord, please engage me in Krishna service. We are asking for service. We are asking to be engaged in devotional service, unalloyed devotional service, unconditional devotional service. The question becomes, is this what we actually want? This is a very important question. Do we want devotional service? Do we want unconditional devotional service? Or are we interested in happiness? Are we interested in freedom from misery? Are we interested in freedom from suffering? Are we interested in gaining spiritual favor? What is our motivation? What is our desire? What is our interest? Because the Maha Mantra, the very powerful Maha Mantra, is asking for one thing and one thing only, and that is, please give me service. We know this in the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Chaturvedhava jantimam jhana sukriti norijuna artho jigyasu artharati jnani cha bharatakshabha. Right? Four kinds of pious persons begin to render service unto me, Krishna says. The distressed, the desire of wealth, the inquisitive, and he or she who is searching for knowledge of the absolute truth. Where do we fit in those categories? Are we the distressed and simply want some kind of alleviation of our misery? A minimization of our misery, of our discomfort, of our pain? Or are we in the second category? We want to incur the favor of the Supreme. If we have the blessings and the favor of Krishna, then we can glide through life with ease, with comforts, with pleasure. Or are we in the third category, where we are curious? What is this ISKCON all about? What is this Krishna consciousness all about? I tried Buddhism. Let me try a little Hinduism or Krishna consciousness. Let me try a little Christianity. I was trying Christianity. Let me try a little Krishnanity, right? Curiosity. Are we in that category? Or are we actually seeking knowledge for the absolute truth? These are very important considerations for ourselves, because we're chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, the purpose of which is to ask, is to beg for devotional service. The question arises, do you want service? That is the key question. If we're seeking happiness, if we're seeking the elimination of pain, then we have to understand that our chanting is laced with aparad. We know this as Mataji just recited the 10 offenses against the chanting of the holy name of the Lord. Right? To think the chanting of the holy names is karmakanda. That's what karmakanda is. Karmakanda, I was just giving a class yesterday on karma yoga, not karmakanda, but we touched on this. That's what karmakanda is. Karmakanda is, I may give some worship, right? That's a big one. I do Satyanarayan Puja. Many people come to the temple and they're asking for Satyanarayan Puja. This is Karmakanda. Purifying, but it's still in that category. Right? I do some Karmakanda. I do some Puja. I do some Vrat. And I should be blessed accordingly. I do some Puja. I do some Vrat. I engage in some Prayaschitta. And anything that I have done bad should be nullified. So I do not have to incur or experience the miseries of some bad activity I may have done. This is karmakanda. If our chanting is laced with these motivations, then we are committing the 7th offense against the chanting of the holy name of the Lord. Now, I'm not saying stop chanting. I want to make that very, very clear. Right? Namaparadiyuttanam namanyavaharantigam. That even if we are chanting with offenses, we should continue to chant. so that we may gradually chant offensively. I believe even Lord Shiva has said this to Parvati, right? When we chant with offenses, the cure is to be aware of those offenses, certainly, but then continue to chant, right? And we will gradually chant offenselessly. So I'm not saying stop chanting, but I'm saying we must be aware of our motivations. We must be aware of what the Hare Krishna Mahamantra actually is. We are asking for service. When I was serving in the Boston Temple, when you're a position of leadership in a temple and when you're a parent, in those two positions, you have to be aware of every minute of your day, right? You're so busy taking care of either the temple or or the children. Parents and temple managers are the best time management experts. Parents and temple managers. So when I was serving in the Boston Temple, chanting my rounds, I try to get my rounds done early in the morning, because once the day begins, everything goes out the window, right? And it was one very strong lesson I learned because of some difficulties of my own. And the schedule, just a little bit of background so the story makes sense. In the Boston Temple at the time, I believe even so now, we do the Boga run to go shopping in the morning, on Saturday morning, early morning, around Japa time, Guru Puja time, because that's when the farmer's market opens, and we drive to this place in Boston where the farmer's market opens, and we get many, many, all the best fresh vegetables cheaply for a good price. And they have a relationship with the farmers there, so it works out very well. But this has to be done. They want us to come early before the whole crowd gets there so that we get a good discount. So there was one devotee. His name is Krishna Leela. Wonderful, wonderful devotee in the Boston Temple. He's still serving there now, Krishna Leela. So he does this. He's been doing this every day for 2-3 decades almost, consistently. On the rare, very rare occasion that he is not around or he's visiting his family, he's from Croatia, so once a year, once every 2 years, he goes to visit his family. Whatever the case may be, I was chanting my rounds in the temple, and someone came to me, "Mahavishnu, Mahavishnu, Krishna Leela is not here. He's not. He can't go to do the Boga run this morning," for whatever reason it was. And immediately, I became upset and disturbed in mind. Now, let's recognize how foolish that was of me. Here I am, chanting, "My dear Krishna, please engage me in your service." Service comes my way, an opportunity to serve so that Krishna Leela is not put into difficulty, right? The opportunity comes to serve. When I was asking for service, and I become disturbed in mind, I become upset and angry. This is the impurity. This is what happens when we come to chanting from a mood or in a mood of karmakanda, right? That impure quality of chanting results in being upset, disturbed, when the opportunities for seva arise. Because it is the opportunities for seva that is the consequence of chanting. So truly, it is not about picking up our beads to chant. It's actually about putting down our beads to serve. Is that clear? It is not about picking up our beads to chant, though that must be done, right? Those of us who've had diksha initiation and so on, we must do our japa 16 rounds a day for sure. So yes, pick up our beads, chant with attention, with focus. But more important, I won't say more important, as significant as picking up our beads and chanting with attention, as significant as that is how we put down our beads to begin to serve. Putting down our beads to begin our service is as telling, is as significant as our state of mind where we're picking up our beads to chant. because a devotee is not in the karmakanda mentality. We are not trying to increase our satisfaction and fulfillment and our happiness. That is not why we chant. In the beginning, as neophytes, when we first come to Krishna consciousness, we may have all kinds of motivations, for sure. All kinds of motivations. But as hopefully we mature and grow, we listen to the lectures of our spiritual masters, we listen to the teachings of the acharyas, we endeavor, we are aware of our anarthas as much as possible, then we have to move past an immature understanding of what chanting is. We have to move past the karmakanda mentality of wanting to experience pleasure, satisfaction, wanting to eliminate misery or distress. When Krishna had a headache, he asked for the dust of the feet of the Brahmanas to soothe his headache. The Brahmanas refused. Why? Because of a mentality of karmakanda. This mentality of karmakanda is, if I give the dust of my feet to Krishna, I will go to hell. It is the wrong thing to do from a karmakanda standpoint. When the gopis were asked, Krishna needs the dust of your feet for his head, before the sentence was even completed, the gopis were scraping the bottom of their feet for the dust for Krishna's headache. Practicing bhakti yoga. The path, the process of bhakti yoga is not about experiencing happiness and pleasure or alleviating distress. Those results are secondary. Lord Chaitanya, I think it is very, very telling that Lord Chaitanya only himself left 8 instructions, one of the most important of which is in the example when he says, whether you crush me in your embrace or make me brokenhearted by not being present before me. These are not descriptions of happiness and satisfaction. These are descriptions of suffering in devotional service. These are descriptions of pain in devotional service, right? Whether you crush me in your embrace or make me brokenhearted by not being present before me. This is not the mentality of a person who is concerned or a person who is beset with the karmakanda mentality. This is not how they describe their spiritual practice. So as bhakti yogis, the understanding that our activity, our practices, is not about alleviating my distress, my pain, my suffering. It is not about increasing my satisfaction or fulfillment. It is not about me. It is about service to Krishna. It is about unconditional service. Sometimes when I give lectures at yoga studios are very interesting places to talk about bhakti yoga. I often tell them, it's a very simplistic way of describing bhakti yoga, but it also enables people to understand what bhakti yoga actually is. I often say that bhakti yoga is the only yoga process that requires 2 people. Every other yoga process, practice, can be done once you learn. It can be done on your own. You can do your own yoga practice in the home, in the studio, but it basically can be practiced by yourself, except bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga requires requires two people, the lover and the beloved. Then you add to that unconditional love. You add to that the mood of Mura Chaitanya, where you can make me brokenhearted by not being present before me. Unconditional love. That means we love regardless of whether or not it is requited. Regardless of whether or not it is returned or reciprocated. That is unconditional love. Now the question becomes, is that what we want? This is a very, very important question for us. Are we at that stage in our development that we actually want unconditional love? Are we actually ready to take the dust from our feet, put it on our spiritual master's head, even though we're going to go to jail if that's what he requires? Are we ready for that? I'm using these examples to try to shake our mind loose of some ideas. This is unconditional love. When we have this understanding, then when we look at today's verse, and it's described that it's hard to understand why some people go to heaven and why some people go to hell. For the devotee, this is easy to understand. For the devotee who is mature in unconditional love, this is very easy to understand because heaven and hell are no different for the unalloyed devotee of the Lord. There's that famous, right, the blessings of the sadhu, right? I'll tell the story because stories are always fun. What's the time? Yes. The sadhu was walking with his disciples the town. They came upon the prince. And the prince offered his pranam, and the sadhu said, "May you live forever." And the prince was happy, went on his way. They came to the Gurukula, and there was a brahmachari outside the Gurukula sleeping. And the sadhu said, "May you die right now." And the disciple of the sadhu, who was walking with the spiritual master, he understood when he gave the blessing to the prince, "May you live forever." But when his spiritual master told the brahmachari, "Bless the brahmachari, may you die right now," the disciple was a little, what does that mean? But he did not say anything. They kept walking. They passed by a butcher shop. The butcher offered his pranam, and the sadhu said, the spiritual master said, "May you neither live nor die." And the butcher made a frowning face. Oh, these sadhus, who can say what they mean? The disciple also did not understand what his spiritual master meant by that. But he kept his peace and he kept walking with the spiritual master. And they were walking by the temple. At the temple, there was one bhakta doing some service, doing some cleaning, whatever it was, right? And the bhakta, the devotee, offered pranams to the sadhu. And the sadhu says, "Whether you live or die, whatever it may be, so be it." And now the disciple of the spiritual master was completely confused. So after they walked some distance, the disciple said to the spiritual master, "Gurudev, you saw four different people, you gave four different people completely different blessings. You even told the brahmachari to die. Why would you tell a brahmachari to die?" And of course the spiritual master, we know the story, the spiritual master had to explain. The prince is living an affluent life, completely involved in sense enjoyment. So let him go on enjoying his senses, because after death, the bill will come due, and it's not going to be so pleasant. So better he just live forever, because that's what he wants in gratification. If he lives forever, that's what he'll get, because when the bill comes, it's not going to be very nice. For the brahmachari, let him die right now, because in the situation he's in now, he has perfected his situation. If he dies now, he'll be directly liberated. In the future, who knows what happens to the brahmachari? He may become overwhelmed by material nature, and who knows what his situation will be. Let him die now, before he gets trapped by sense gratification. Right? So better he die now. And we know the butcher. A butcher's life is already heinous, is already disgusting. If he dies, he's going to have even more suffering. So better he doesn't die, doesn't live. I mean, who can say what's good for him? Right? For the devotee is transcendental. Whether he lives or dies, so be it. They are transcendental no matter where they are. This is the platform we have to come to. When we look at this verse, those who are seeing only the level of karmakanda cannot understand. But the devotee recognizes heaven or hell, calamitous situations or wonderful situations is irrelevant for the devotee. Because a devotee is not seeking, is not experiencing existence on that level. The devotee is solely engaged, solely involved in unconditional love. In our chanting, that's what we're chanting for. That's what our prayer is for. Service. Unconditional loving service. Now, it is easy to serve Krishna. It is actually very easy. Let's be honest. Come on. Let's be honest. It is very easy to serve Krishna. Krishna is within our heart. He's always with us. He is the best friend we've ever had. Really, really. I'm serious here. It is very easy. It is not difficult at all to serve Krishna, especially when we're neophytes. Especially when we're neophytes, it is very easy to serve Krishna. It may take a little bit of self-discipline, a little bit of time management, but essentially it is very, very easy to serve Krishna and think we're doing it with unconditional love. Very easy. Now the question is, can you serve with unconditional love your mother-in-law? Now it gets difficult. Can you serve with unconditional love your wife? Now it becomes different. Can you serve with unconditional love your husband, your uncle, your children, your coworker, other devotees in the temple, the congregation member who was criticizing you behind your back? Do we have the spirit of unconditional love in those situations? Now we begin to understand what unconditional love actually is. Now we begin to understand what devotional service actually means. Because we're supposed to know, right? Vidya vinaya sampane brahmane gavi hastini suni chaiva sopakata pandita samadharshina, right? The humble sages, Prabhupada put humble in there. The humble sages, by virtue of true knowledge, see with equal vision. A learned and gentle brahmana, a cow, an elephant, a dog, and a dog eater, or an outcast. When we are mature in our devotional service, our unconditional love for Krishna becomes manifest in every single one of our relationships. Because we see every single jivatma, we see every single living entity as part and parcel of Krishna. We see the truth. The humble sage, by virtue of true knowledge. That is what that verse is saying. Unconditional love, serving Krishna, is easy. Comparatively, to serving others. That's where the wheels fall off the cart. We lose our mentality we lose our consciousness, we lose our ability to serve with unconditional love if it's anyone other than Krishna. What does that say about our devotional service? Another quick story. This was years ago. Wow, this was in Mayapur. We had a teacher in Mayapur Gurukula. This was in the mid, late 80s, actually. And one of the teachers there, his name was Atmatattva Prabhu. Some of you may know him. He was from South India, Prabhupada's disciple, wonderful devotee, extremely well-versed in Prabhupada's books and in scriptural knowledge. And during the Mayapur Festival, that month during the Mayapur Festival, the Mayapur Gurukula would close. It would close in the sense that we would not have classes, right? The students, we did not have classes during the Mayapur Gurukula. And we participated and we served the sannyasis and so on and so forth. So during that month, when the school was not having academic classes, the classrooms were used by the visiting sannyasis and senior devotees to give seminars during the Mayapur Festival. I don't know how it is now. I've not been to Mayapur in quite some time. So Atmatattva Prabhu would give seminars in the Gurukula in one of the Gurukula classrooms. And many devotees, many devotees would attend. You know, so the classrooms that he would have would be filled with 60, 70 devotees attending his seminars. And we, the Gurukul students, we would sit by. We were very, very awestruck by so many senior devotees. So it was very exciting for us as young students. Atmatattva Prabhu would give his seminars. And at the end, this one particular year, he told everybody that he was giving a seminar. I forget what the topic was. It was so many years ago. I was too young to remember. But I remember this much. There was supposed to be an exam at the end of his seminar after the 2 weeks of the seminar period during the festival. So at the end of the seminar, everyone came. It was incredible. This was an incredible experience for me and for all of my friends, all of us who were there as students. Because in Atmatattva Prabhu's seminar, there were senior devotees, Prabhupada disciples, sannyasis, GVC devotees. So it was a very, very powerful experience to have witnessed this. So on the day of the examination, all the devotees were there, senior devotees, GVC devotees. And Atmatattva Prabhu, he always started his seminars with Jai Radha Madhava, invocation, obeisance to Srila Prabhupada, and then he stood up. And that was surprising, because we all expected, you know, he would have his seminar and it would go on. He stood up and he asked everybody in the class to follow him. And I remember this because we were sitting, myself and some friends, we were sitting in one area of the Gurukula, and we saw Atmatattva Prabhu walking out of the classrooms with 50, 60 devotees, sannyasis, GBC, ladies, men, following him, coming towards the center of the Gurukula. And we were, what's going on here? So we got up, we got out of the way. We had no idea what was going on. And we started to follow them. And what Atmatattva Prabhu had done was he walked, he took all the devotees to the center of the Gurukula. And in the center of Gurukula, there were a pile of brooms. Now, you know those brooms. This is back in the 1980s. So you know those brooms in India where you have to bend yourself in half. It's not like the Swiffers we have here in the United States, right? He had a big pile of those brooms, and he gave a broom to each and every one of those devotees. Now, these were sannyasis, GBC devotees, senior Prabhupada disciples, ladies, everybody. Every single person in his class, he gave them a broom, and he told them to sweep the entire Gurukula. I will never forget that experience. Myself, my friends, we were completely shocked by this. And it was even more powerful because many of these devotees had never used that type of broom before. This is Mayapur in February, March. So it's cool by Indian standards in India. Yeah, it's a little cool. But these devotees who are coming from America, Germany, where they just came from freezing weather, this is tropical, humid, hot weather. Devotees were sweating. They were having such a difficult time sweeping the Gurukula. But I will say this. It took them over 2 hours. The sun was setting. I remember this. It was an evening class. So when they were finished generally after Amitabha Prabhu's class, they would finish class and go to the temple for Sandhya Arati. But there were devotees still sweeping during Sandhya Arati because they had such a hard time doing the service. Now, of course, I came to learn later on, Amitabha Prabhu was telling us, that the reason why he had that was going to be the test was that it's so easy to be lost in the theory of Krishna consciousness. But the theory of Krishna consciousness means nothing if we cannot serve. It is seva that transforms our theoretical learning. It is seva that transforms our japa. It is seva that transforms everything we do in our spiritual life into realization. So my foolishly sitting in the Boston temple, thinking I am very seriously chanting my rounds, and then when the devotee comes and says, Mahavishnu, Mahavishnu, someone has to go do the shopping, I become angry. This is neophyte chanting. This is aparad chanting. We know, many of you are Bhakti Shastris, right? We know in Bhakti Shastra, Karma Yoga, the question we must ask ourselves, are we actually Bhakti Yogis? Are we actually Bhakti Yogis? This is a very important question that we must ask and answer ourselves. Because we know from Bhakti Shastri, there is Karma Yoga, right? There are two levels of Karma Yoga, Sakama Karma Yoga and Nishkama Karma Yoga. Sakama Karma Yoga is Karma Yoga where we are attached to the activities and the results of the activities. That is Sakama Karma Yoga. Nishkama Karma Yoga is when we are not attached to the results of our activities. We give them fully to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. However, there is a slight attachment to the type of work, the type of seva that we do. So the question is if we are we on the level of Sakama and Nishkama Karma Yoga? Because to be a Bhakti Yogi means we are not only are we not attached to the results of our activities, we do the best that we can. We put all our effort and we do the best that we can. But we are not attached to the results of our activity, of our seva, nor are we attached to the type of service we are performing. So whether we are worshiping the deity on the altar, worshiping Krishna on the altar, making garlands, shopping at farmers market, cleaning the bathrooms, sweeping the Gurukula, it does not matter what we are doing. The fact that it is being done for Krishna is all that matters. That is Bhakti Yoga. Any attachment in our Bhakti Yoga qualifies it as Karma Yoga. Bhakti Shastris, I'm not telling you anything new. You know this. But it is very important we understand this so that we endeavor to mature and improve. Right? Krishna says, develop a desire to attain me. So we have to recognize the level of our maturity. We have to recognize the anarthas, the aparads we are engaging in. Now, I'm not saying this to discourage. I'm not saying this to demean, to insult, to make you feel like, or make ourselves feel like we're not, oh, what's the use? I'm just going to give up and not do anything. No, I'm saying that because we can naturally and effectively understand how we can improve. We are not living in a false sense of spiritual maturity. our chanting is a very important, obviously, it is a key component of our spiritual development. But as we know, again, many of you are bhakti shastris, so you know this, the karma yogi engages in akarma. Right? The karma yogi engages in giving the results of their activities to the Supreme in order to achieve perfection. That's how the karma yogi achieves perfection. The jnana yogi engages in ashtanga yoga to achieve perfection. It is the bhakti yogi who engages in seva to achieve perfection. That's how it works. The karma yogi does their work, and they make that an offering to the Supreme, and that's how they move towards perfection. The jnana yogi, it is ashtanga. The bhakti yogi, it is seva. That seva component is very, very important. We often miss that part. We get so enraptured in studying shastra, listening to classes. All these things is part of our sadhana, for sure. Chanting, that's all. I'm not saying we should not do those things. Those are things also critical, are inherent part of our devotional service. But the problem is, we sometimes, due to forgetfulness, laziness, ego, we put a less value on seva than we do on these other activities of japa, swadhyaya, study, and so on. And we do not recognize that our mentality in service, our mentality towards service, is a key barometer, is a key understanding or measurement of understanding our devotional maturity. So again, going back to the point, recognize not only how we feel when we pick up our japa beads, but also be keenly aware of our mentality, of our consciousness, when we put down our japa beads to do service. Be aware of that mentality of what we're thinking of our consciousness when we are required or asked to serve. Because that's what japa is. Japa is a request to Radha and Krishna for service. That unconditional service to the Lord. And that, again, on a certain level, is easier than serving the person sitting right next to us. The devotee in the congregation who was criticizing us behind our back. How do we serve them with unconditional love? We have to ask ourselves these questions, and we have to answer them truthfully. And with this understanding, further engage, further focus, further be attentive in our service, in our chanting, in our attendance in the morning program, in our study of the shastra, in our listening to the words of the spiritual master. We have to have a keen understanding of where we are situated, as best as possible. So I'll end there. If there are any questions or comments, please share. Hari Hari.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. Thank you for a very fascinating class. I do have a couple of questions. I do have a couple of questions. One is, when you're speaking of the fact that our chanting is a cry for service. It seems to me that the service you're referring to is one of more what is commonly referred to as practical service, or you can maybe say physical service. But my problem with that is that it seems to diminish the fact that hearing, such as what we're doing right now, is also service. You know, we've all put down our beads so that we can hear this lecture. And so I was wondering if you would comment on this concern.
That is true, actually. You make a very, very good point. Hearing is definitely service. I was actually just, we restarted Gurukula. We had a one-month summer, short summer break for Gurukula, and we restarted just last week. And I was, the first class I was giving to the kids, I was talking about service. And I was saying, as Gurukula students, your service is to study. That is their service as Gurukula students. In the Gurukula, their service is to study to the best of their ability, to serve and work, or to study with discipline, to not cause, that's their actual, that is their service to Krishna. So yes, other types of service that is non-physical is absolutely, that's a valid point you make. I'm not diminishing one type of service over another, but sometimes there is an insidious intrusion of ego when it comes to physical service. One quick, this is funny, one quick story. Several months ago at the temple, we were talking about, because the temple is growing, thanks to Srila Prabhupada's mercy and Krishna's mercy. It's growing, and we're exploring, well, what's going to happen when we have to move out of this location and get another location, and the bills that are going to come with that. And where we are now in Northborough, we have a very wonderful situation in that the cleaning the temple is actually done by, I'm renting the space, the temple is being rented from another organization, and that's owned by a very pious Indian family. So they actually paid for the cleaning of the entire facility, and that includes the temple. So the temple has public bathrooms, but the cleaning of the public bathrooms is done by this family that owns the building. And so they pay for the cleaning of the entire building, and it also includes the temple's public bathrooms. So we're this came up in our meeting that, okay, what's going to happen? There's going to be a lot of extra when we move to a bigger place. Not only will there be more bills in terms of rent and mortgage or whatever it may be, but there's also going to be cleaning bills. And there was one objection: well, who's going to clean the bath? Who's going to clean the bathroom? And there was silence in the meeting, right? Who's going to? No one raised their hand to clean the bathrooms. So there's the meeting went on. We don't need to go into more detail than that. But sometimes physical seva or a certain type of seva is diminished because of our laziness, or more commonly, our ego. Right? We want to be the ones who make the garlands for the deities, but we don't want to be the ones who have to clean the pots in the kitchen after Janmashtami. We want to be the ones who decorate the altar so everyone can see it, but we don't want to be the ones who have to do the wiring on the altar after or before the program. You see what I mean? So certain types of seva we put on a higher altar.
Mm-hmm.
And it is that mentality where you put seva on various aspects of hierarchy that is the problem. But once mm-hmm. we are mature in our understanding, then seva is seva, whether it's the bathroom mm-hmm. cleaning or garland making or reading or studying Gurukul, whatever it may be. So that was a very good point to bring up, so we can clarify that.
Well, yeah, that was a beautiful, beautiful clarification. I really appreciate that. You know, I never understood it in that light before, and it's really a really wonderful illumination, you know.
Thank you.
That, you know, that, yeah, this aversion to the menial aspects of some types of service is what we should,
Like that's what was so surprising for us Gurukul kids when we saw Admatatva Prabhu bring all these senior devotees to sweep, because as Gurukul kids, we did that. It was a service that no one in Gurukul, we hated sweeping the Gurukul. We had to sweep the Gurukul twice a day, every day. We hated it. And when Admatatva Prabhu bought sannyasis and GBC devotees and senior Prabhupada disciples, these are persons we would offer obeisances to every day when we saw them, and he's bringing them in, he's giving them brooms, and he's literally forcing them, so to speak, to sweep the Gurukul. And we were shocked. And that's why that lesson stuck with me 30 years later. Because my own ego saw it as menial service. My own ego thought it was a degrading service to be. So that was a very powerful witness as well. I'm sorry, I think I interrupted you.
Oh, I don't think so. But you said it was, what shocked you was that the Gurukulis were being forced to sweep.
The devotees, yeah. They weren't being forced to, but Amitabha Prabhu basically, he basically surprised them. The sannyasis and GBC devotees, he surprised them, took them to the middle of the Gurukula, and had them sweep. So it was shocking to us. Kids, yeah.
Oh, so it was the sannyasis who were put to sweep.
Yes, yes, yes. It was the sannyasis who were sweeping. And that shocked us.
Okay.
Yeah, he saw sweeping as a genial. Sannyasis aren't supposed to sweep.
The
lesson was, why not? Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu swept. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it was very, very powerful. It's a lesson I feel, you know, helped me with my own ego. You know, when we do move the temple and we don't have someone to pay for the cleaning of the bathrooms, guess what? I'm going to clean the bathrooms.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to swallow my ego and clean the bathrooms.
Yeah, I think it's just such a little known understanding that cleaning the bathrooms is absolutely equal to, you know, dressing the deities. You know, people feel like it's like, you know, if you're dressing, if you have that service to dress the deities, then Krishna must have really blessed you or really have special favor upon you.
Yes.
But a person who's cleaning a bathroom, they could claim that same favor.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that is just so a rare piece of knowledge.
Yes.
But I do have another question, but I know I've engaged you a long time, so maybe I give somebody else a chance. But if you come back to me, I'd appreciate it.
Sure, certainly will do so.
Okay, thank you.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. Thank you very much for an extremely enlivening class, as always. I have a question, rather a realization, and maybe you can comment on it. So in my younger years in Krishna consciousness, say about a decade ago, when I was a new devotee and I was asked to chant, and, you know, if I was chanting, I was told by some experienced devotees that, you know, if you're chanting and somebody asks you to do something, you should tell them, I'm chanting and I cannot do the service. And that stuck with me in my younger years, and I used to do that. Now, after a decade, I feel that every little service is an opportunity, as I have grown in my Krishna consciousness and, you know, listening to your lectures and many other devotees, you know, every service given to us is an answer to our chanting. I have come to that realization, and so that's why now, you know, every little service opportunity, I try not to let it pass by, and I try to grab onto that, and that's a mood that I am trying to cultivate. But you know, in my younger years, I would just tell them, I'm sorry, I'm chanting right now, and just go on my business and not even feel bad about it. So what do you think about that devotee giving me that advice then, Hare Krishna?
I think that's absolutely wonderful that you know, as we all grow and mature in our Krishna consciousness, our realizations grow with us. I will also say that initial instruction to chant, no matter what someone comes to say with you, just say, no, not now. That's also important. We should not discredit that or discount. I'm not saying you are. I'm not saying that. But from another perspective, understanding what that devotee may have been trying to get at is we also have to jealously guard our time of chanting, right? If it's something that is capricious or frivolous, that is something else, right? Many a time, we've all had this experience, right? We're sitting and chanting, and our spouse will come and say something. We're sitting and chanting, our child will come and do something. We don't properly husband that time. We don't properly guard the time for chanting. So it could have been in that mood. But so we do have to have that balance of recognizing when it's someone is interrupting because they have not organized their own time properly, right? Then, you know, there's, and also if you're in a position of safety, a position of leadership in your family or in a temple, sometimes you may have to question, what do you need right now? Can it wait? Can it be done after breakfast? Can you take care of it? So we have to, there has to be an understanding, a judgment. But the key, and that's, I think what you point out to is really, really important. The key is the recognition, the realization that the opportunity to serve is what ignites our bhakti yoga. Remember, the process of bhakti yoga is ignited, if you will, or transformed through seva. For the jnana yogi, it's ashtanga. For the karma yogi, it is a karma activity. It is a selfless act, not seva, but offering activities to the Supreme. So for each process, there's a method that transforms the theory into realization. For bhakti yogis, it is seva. So opportunities to serve, not just some capricious, you know, someone's coming and wants to waste our time with something. That, of course, we have to be focused and we have to guard our time of japa. But it's so wonderful to hear you say that you recognize opportunities to serve as exactly correct, an answering to our japa, because that's what it is. It is an answering to our japa. And our mentality, when being asked to serve, is as important as our mentality while chanting. We can be completely absorbed in chanting Hare Krishna and have full concentration, but when we are asked to serve, if I immediately revert to anger, that is an aparad. That is an aparad. Because that means I'm on the level of karma kanda. I'm on the level of what is pleasing to me at this moment. What is pleasing to me is my chanting. But that's irrelevant. Bhakti yoga, that is irrelevant. Bhakti yoga means what is pleasing to Krishna. If seva right now is pleasing to Krishna, if serving Krishna, that interrupts my japa, is pleasing to Krishna, then that's what's most important. It is our consciousness when being asked to serve is also as important as our consciousness while chanting. That is so wonderful to hear your realization like that. Thank you for sharing it.
Thank you, Prabhu. Just along those lines, as you were talking, another thought crossed my mind that I would do, if that's okay.
Please.
Thank you. So, you know, again, in my younger years, I'm a physician. So in my younger years, you know, when I was asked for donations, it would irritate me, and I would feel that, oh, because I'm a physician, you know, they're always coming after me for asking donations. It would really irritate me, very irritating. But now, I mean, should I still be looking at it as they're asking me to give me an opportunity to serve, because, you know, every time being asked for fundraising sometimes can get irritating. So what are your thoughts on that?
Is that what?
Is that also like something that I should look at every opportunity to donate? Because if I go to Mayapur or anywhere, you know, it's like, okay, you know, I'm introduced as, oh, she's such and such, she's a doctor, and you can give 50,000. So I feel like, oh my gosh, they're after me here. I still get those kind of feelings. Should I take that also as an opportunity that, okay, Krishna is giving me this opportunity and I should take it? Because sometimes, you know, we do kind of look at it materially also, you know, not always spiritually, especially when it comes to, you know, money. Unfortunately, what are your thoughts or comments on that?
There is a nice, a very nice phrase, or a very nice, not a phrase. I guess you call it a word for this. Not for this, what you're saying, but there's a very nice word I'm going to share with you. It's Norwegian. It's called dumsnil. It's an excellent word. It's dum. Means, like in English, dumb, right? Doom means dumb. Snil means kindness. So put together is called doom snil. In other words, stupid kindness. Now, wait. I'm not saying you're stupid. Let me finish, okay? What I'm saying is the opportunity that you are getting is not just to give donations. You're highly educated. You obviously have abilities beyond just money. You are given opportunities on a wide range. So you should see it not simply as an opportunity to give money. Certainly that is there. But it's also an opportunity to be responsible for how that money is being spent. That is as important as well. It is not just to just give money, and to be, I'm not calling you doomsnil. I do not mean it. I'm just saying that we have to recognize that there are also responsibilities involved. Not that we should just allow Krishna's Lakshmi to be squandered. We should not allow people to be irresponsible. If a president comes to you, if I come to you and I ask you for a donation, yet you find out that the temple accounts are not being run correctly, don't give the donation. That is also your service. Your service is to protect Lakshmi. So when someone comes, when a devotee, a senior devotee, whomever it may be, asks you for a donation of $50,000, there are several layers of opportunities here, opportunities to serve. One is the obvious one, to give the $50,000 or rupee, whatever it is. The other opportunities is to find out, take the initiative to find out what is it for, to find out has there been mismanagement of Krishna's Lakshmi. This is, it's not money. You are entrusted, you have an incredible responsibility, and you're incredibly fortunate to be entrusted with, you are a guardian of Lakshmi. That's how you have to see yourself. And it is your duty to give, to return as much Lakshmi as possible to Krishna. Absolutely. But it is not to, you don't just send Lakshmi away capriciously to whomever asks. I was actually at a, this is very funny. I was actually doing a wedding ceremony about last year. And I was talking about the ceremonies. It was an Indian family, bride was Indian, and the husband was Caucasian-American. So in such situations, you have to explain every single aspect. I mean, you should always explain every single aspect of the ritual. But in this case, I really had to go into detail because of the non-Indian side of the family so that they could understand, they could follow and be included. So I was explaining kanyadan, right? Giving the daughter as charity. Now you can imagine charity in relation to women in the age of the Me Too movement and feminism, and so I had to unpack the idea of kanyadan. And kanyadan is the family is giving the best of their dynasty which is their daughter, in charity. Charity does not mean something you discard. We know from Bhagavad Gita, charity is only supposed to be given to the most qualified persons. Charity in the mode of goodness, right? 18th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Charity in the mode of goodness means charity that is given to the most qualified person. Kanyadan means the family is giving the best of their dynasty, their daughter, in charity to someone who's the most highly qualified to take care of her. In the same way, you have Lakshmi in your possession. When you give Lakshmi back to Krishna, so to speak, you have to make sure that she is going to the most qualified initiative, the most qualified project, the most qualified home. So that is also part of the service of giving in charity. Don't just sign the check. Don't just sign the check. Find out about the project. Find out who's managing it. Find out if that person manages Krishna's Lakshmi, if he manages, if he takes care of the goddess of fortune properly. That is also your service.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's my, how I would share with that.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
And please, I didn't mean to call you Doomsayam. I didn't mean that. I was just using that term to recognize that there's more responsibility than to just be charitable. Especially for those of us who have responsibilities of Krishna's resources. So there's many layers of service. So I did not mean to offend at all.
Yes, Prabhu, I understood your point. Thank you very much. Really appreciate
it. Hare Krishna, Prabhu. This is Damodarananda Das. Really enjoyed your lecture and more the question-answer session. It was so wonderful. The questions were so nice. And your answers so nice. And I just want to add a little bit about the, you know, getting disturbed while you're chanting. And that happens because there are services to be done, as you said. But it's also etiquette on the part of the person who disturbs somebody in chanting that he should see that he or she can wait to ask somebody who's chanting to do something. And there are many anecdotes of Prabhupada telling some devotee who did not want to do service, not that he was pretending that he's chanting, that he will miss his chanting, and Prabhupada said the service is more important, and then you can, you know, forego your chanting. So those examples are there. And what I have, you know, during my, you know, Krishna conscious life, I have come to this, that if you do your chanting in the early morning, Brahma Muhurta, then there's no chance of anybody disturbing you unless you're living in a temple or an ashram. So that was my best way of getting away from getting disturbed while you're chanting. I just wanted to share that. Hare Krishna.
Very nice. Thank you. Hare Krishna, Prabhuji.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah. So I just wanted to let you know that this Damodarananda Prabhu, he chants every day, 5:10, 5:15, he starts chanting and until 7:20 he keeps chanting. Oh, thank you so much.
Very nice. Yes, whenever I come on the phone call, I always hear his chanting. It's very, very enlivening, and I keep it going in the background. It's very, very nice.
Also, isn't Damodar Prabhu like an hour ahead of us? So it is like 4:40 for his time? I always think about that. Is he not in the other time zone also?
Yes, he is one hour behind us. Yeah, 4:15 he comes.
Always there. It's always there,
yeah. It's always there.
Mataji, you wanted me to come back. You had a second question you wanted to go over? Hare Krishna. Is there anything else?
Hare Krishna?
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was trying to chime back in or unmute and I pressed the wrong button. Yeah, I do still have a couple of questions. One is that I wasn't really getting your point properly when you were trying to explain how easy Krishna consciousness is compared to, you know, serving, you know, maybe family members or serving those who might be inimical to you. So is it that, you know, it's comparatively easy because serving Krishna just means chanting and taking advantage of opportunities, whereas serving others I don't know, I'm not really so sure actually why you would.
Well, I will, that's really a very personal realization I was sharing. What I meant was, for myself, is that reading about Krishna, trying to focus on my japa, serving in a temple, and meditating on Krishna, for me, it's easier to do that because I am trying to engage with Krishna. I'm trying to be conscious of Krishna. I'm trying to be focused on Krishna. And that is easier for me, than it is to work cooperatively with another devotee that I may have an ego issue with, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it becomes easy. So I would actually refrain from interacting with that devotee and go and chant my rounds, because it's actually easier for me in that sense to think that I'm doing Krishna service and my consciousness better because I can chant, rather than focusing on or dealing with cooperating with that particular devotee. Which is, I will actually, and my realization is just this. Actually, it was quite interesting. I'll try to make the story a little brief. I was divorced. And Bhakti Vidyapuna Maharaj, I was trying to get some inspiration from him. And Bhakti Vidyapuna Maharaj said, well, Mahavishnu, it's great that you're, you know, focusing on your chanting. It's great that you're focusing on your sadhana to help you get to your divorce. He was saying, however, the most important thing you can do to improve or to grow spiritually in this situation is to see, deal, and work with your now ex-wife appropriately and properly. That is as important as your chanting. Just to run to the temple, hide in the temple and chant, yet at the same time have inimical mentality towards your ex-wife now, is detrimental to your devotional service. It is as important to deal with that situation appropriately and properly.
And that's why I had the confusion, actually, because I was thinking the same thing, that, you know, your dealings with all these different living entities can also be service. So it was like to call one thing service and to call these other things something, it seemed like you were calling it something other than service to Krishna, then it could all be called service to Krishna.
Yes.
That's why I was confused.
Yes, it certainly could all be service to Krishna. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So then basically you're saying that maybe what's like direct service can be easier than this this service that becomes service based on your consciousness, you know?
Yes. The particular point I was making was we're talking about people and personalities, right? Because, as I mentioned, like, bhakti yoga is requires two people: unconditional love to Krishna, unconditional mm-hmm. service to Krishna. Theoretically, that is easier for, I'll speak for myself, it's easier for me to believe I'm engaged in unconditional service to Krishna. It takes a little bit of discipline, a little bit of time management, but I can wrap my consciousness around unconditionally doing service for Krishna. But the same idea to unconditionally serve a devotee in a temple I don't get along with is much, much more difficult for my mind and my ego to deal with. But mm-hmm. that is as important as my service to Krishna. Does that yeah. make sense? Did that help? Or did I just confuse the issue more?
No, I think I understand you. Just like when you were speaking, then and now, when you were talking about how much easier it is to serve Krishna than other living entities, mm-hmm. you know, because serving Krishna, yeah, it might require a little time management, self-discipline, but for me, I mean, this is a little bit of a tangent, but for me, those are the biggest issues, you know? So it's like, you know, I can't minimize those two things because those are my biggest obstacles, you know, self-discipline and time management.
Right. Well, that was a personal realization.
Yeah. okay, and another thing was, when you were breaking down you explained the three different yogas, karma, jnana, and bhakti yoga. And you explained that the way, I have to think out loud to ask this question because, you know, I'm so a little confused about what you're saying. So you said by the karma yogis, they engage in, let's say, selfless activities. And jnana yogis, they engage in ashtanga yoga. And bhakti yogis, they engage in seva. So karma yogis, you said that in karma yoga, there's some attachment. The attachment can be to the fruits if you're a sukkarma yogi, and it's to the type of work if you're a nishkam karma yogi. But in neither of those two cases, you know, the idea, the objective for, let's say, the karma yogis, to distinguish them from bhakti yogis, the objective is what? Liberation from the conception, the bodily conception. It's not yet the relationship they have with Krishna, right? It's simply they're trying to escape the suffering of the bodily conception of life. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes.
Okay, and the way they try to achieve that objective is by becoming detached from the fruits of their work, and also by eventually trying to become detached from the type of work itself also.
Yes, right? Exactly.
Okay, so, and then, say?
Go ahead.
And then you said, the way the process for the jnana yogis is, I thought you said ashtanga yoga, but I thought that jnana yoga was one thing and ashtanga yoga was another. Not that ashtanga yoga was the process for the Jnana Yogi. I thought Jnana Yogis, their process, again, for attaining liberation was just acquiring knowledge, just trying to differentiate between what is spiritual and what is material, rather than the process being Ashtanga Yoga.
Okay. Jnana Yoga is, you're right, to acquire knowledge and understand the difference between matter and spirit. The process to do that is actually meditation. So the Jnana Yogis, they get their instruction from the spiritual master, or they read the Vedanta, but then to realize, to turn that theoretical knowledge into realization, to experience that knowledge, they have to, the process is meditation. So Ashtanga Yoga, we know the first three stages of Ashtanga Yoga is actually the preparatory stage. It is the final three stages of Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi where the yogi is actually engaged in meditation. The first five stages of Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, and Pratyahara, that is in preparation for the meditation. The first five is to prepare the groundwork for the preparation of intense and increasingly deepening the meditation. So it is a meditation that transforms the theory of Jnana into realization, or the experience that matter is separate from spirit. To realize that, to experience the separation of matter and spirit, and to experience the oneness of their own Atma to the Paramatma.
The oneness of the... When you say the oneness of the Atma with
the
Paramatma...
The oneness of Jivatma to actually... The oneness of Jivatma to Brahman. Now, to Brahman, not Paramatma. Now, the key is that in Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga, there is no automatic realization of Bhagavan, of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's possible, and it certainly is, I shouldn't say possible, it can be a natural step from realization from in Jnana Yoga and Karma Yoga to come to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but that requires to get to Bhagavan or Krishna always requires bhakti. That last step always requires bhakti. So from the Jnana Yogi to get Bhagavan realization will require bhakti, and also for the Karma Yogi. The Karma Yogi can be perfected in Karma Yoga, but the realization of Krishna as the Supreme Personality of God and to have a relationship with Krishna, bhakti is always the missing ingredient.
Okay. So I have to back up a little bit. So the Ashtanga Yoga process, like you're saying, the first five steps prepare you for the last three, which is meditation.
Yes.
And so because of that, it seems like Ashtanga Yoga is a combination of, well, you said Jnana Yoga, the process is meditation, so that seems like the last three steps of Ashtanga Yoga.
Yes.
And so since the last three steps is Jnana Yoga, then Ashtanga Yoga seems to be a combination of whatever you would call the first five steps and Jnana Yoga. It seems like a melding of...
I'm not quite sure I follow that, but let me see if I could explain it differently. I could be saying this wrong.
Because, you see, the thing is The Jnana, like you said, is a process of turning the theoretical into the realized through the process of meditation. But Ashtanga Yoga, it includes that meditation. And so I'm trying to tease apart Jnana Yoga and Ashtanga Yoga, since Ashtanga Yoga seems to include, by the meditative part of it, it seems to include Jnana Yoga. So I'm trying to tease these two apart.
Okay, yeah, I said it wrong. Jnana Yoga is the path of knowledge, the process of knowledge, to know the difference between matter and spirit and the relationships between the two. Knowledge. Now, that can be explained to the disciple by the spiritual master, that can be read and understood theoretically from Vedanta. Then the spiritual master would tell the disciple, Jnana Yogi, now that I've told you that matter and spirit are separate, now that I told you that you are one with Brahman, now you go realize it. Now you go experience it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's use a different word. So the spiritual master would then tell the Jnana Yogi disciple to go engage their sadhana. Their sadhana would be the Ashtanga Yoga process.
Okay.
First five steps to prepare them for their meditation, then they begin their meditation, and in their meditation, the realization begins the deeper they go towards, you know, from dharana to dhyana into samadhi, and in samadhi, then they gain that experiential, that experience of being one with Brahman. Did that make any sense? I hope I said it.
That was what I needed to hear.
Okay.
That it was very cleared it all up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so the objective, once again, how would you characterize the objective of the Jnana Yogi? And because the objective of the Sangha Yogi, I thought, was to realize the Paramatma in the heart. And the objective of the Jnana Yoga Yogi was to realize his oneness with Brahman. Is this correct?
The realization, yes and no, because the realization of, we're talking about the personal feature of the Supreme and the impersonal feature of the Supreme. So if the Jnana Yogi, if their proclivity or the inclination is atheistic or impersonal, then they will realize Brahman. They will experience and see or experience Brahman. If the inclination or the proclivity of the yogi is personal or theistic, then their samadhi, their realization, will be Paramatma. It depends on, like Krishna says, as all surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. How the person comes to Krishna in their Jnana Yoga, they will receive, they will realize accordingly.
Mm-hmm. So a person in Ashtanga Yoga doesn't necessarily realize Paramatma. A person engaged in
Absolutely not.
Oh. Okay, because somehow, I don't... Do you understand why I have always... Because I feel like I've always heard this, that the objective of the Ashtanga Yogi is to realize Paramatma. Don't we always hear this?
Ashtanga, well, that is not incorrect. Because one can engage in Ashtanga Yoga and certainly realize Paramatma. But if a person can also engage in Ashtanga Yoga and not realize Paramatma.
Mm-hmm.
There is no guarantee that an Ashtanga Yogi, when obtaining or attaining samadhi, will realize Paramatma. That is not a guarantee. Is really the point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's why later on in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, "I will now explain to you the most confidential knowledge. The most confidential knowledge is that in order to see Krishna as he is requires bhakti, and that is not automatic."
But still, we do say, though, that for the Karma Yogi to attain his objective and for the Jnana or Ashtanga Yogi to attain their objective, some, at least even unknowing service to Krishna, must be there, right?
Yes, and that's the trick. That is actually the hidden ingredient, if you will, or the trick of these things. If we properly, and that's why Krishna was saying in the fifth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Sankhya Yoga, Karma Yoga are actually the same. Krishna says, he who applies himself well and properly to one of any of these paths will achieve the result of coming to me. Because a little bit of Krishna is in every path. A little bit of Krishna, it will lead to Krishna. But it only depends on from what angle we are coming from.
So it will lead to Krishna, but the angle with which you get there can be more or less circuitous depending upon your approach.
Depending on your approach, depending on your association, depending on how you're influenced by whether your guru is Sukracharya or not, many different things. But the processes are, for lack of a better term, they are rigged to eventually put you in front of Krishna. Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Bhakti, well, obviously Bhakti, but Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga are rigged in a subtle way. They will bring you to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Whether or not the aspiring yogi realizes that, takes to that, connects with that is a completely different. Adhyatma Sukriti is involved, the mercy of the devotees are all involved. But the goal of every yoga process is to bring us to Krishna. Everything, all these spiritual paths lead to Krishna, essentially. But there can be lots of obstacles along the way in the form of association, cheating gurus, all kinds of things can get in the way of that. But the process are intended to lead us to Krishna and to bhakti yoga.
And so without some degree of bhakti yoga, the karma yogi, he will not understand, he will not get this knowledge of the difference between matter and spirit. That's not possible. Right?
I won't say that because you can certainly realize Brahman without coming through bhakti, right? You can certainly realize, like the karma yogi engages in karma yoga by renouncing the results of their activity and giving up attachments to the results of their activity and giving up the attachments to the activity. That takes a high level of consciousness.
Because he said that none of these yogis can attain their objectives without some touch of bhakti.
Krishna, no. They cannot attain Krishna. They cannot attain to Krishna without some touch of bhakti. Realizing Brahman can be done without a realization of Krishna.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji, can I interject for just a minute from...
Yes, just a second. Realizing Brahman is not required a realization of Krishna. We see all of the sages in the Bhagavatam, the stories of the sages and the saints and so on, who have a realization of Brahman, but no recognition of who Krishna is. So it is certainly possible to achieve Brahman realization without a realization of Krishna.
You can realize Brahman without realization of Krishna. Yes, I know that's true. But my understanding has always been that you cannot attain the particular objective of your particular yoga practice, whether it be karma or jnana, without some touch of bhakti.
I'm not so sure of that. I'll have to research that.
To perfect your jnana yogi practice, or to attain the fruit of your jnana yogi practice, or the fruit of your karma yogi practice, that there has to be bhakti. But so if that's not true, you're saying that without bhakti, you're only saying that without bhakti we cannot attain Krishna. But yeah, so my understanding has always been that you cannot attain the perfection of your of the particular yoga practice without some touch of bhakti.
The way I understand it, and of course Dhammaratu will want to chime in just a moment, but the way I understand it is when the karma yogi or the jnana yogi is progressing in their particular path, by properly following karma yogi or jnana yogi, the natural question arises, or the natural the natural question arises is that who is all this for? There's a question, a leading question in each of these processes that will open a door to Krishna. In karma yoga, when we, the person who's trying to give up attachment to the activities, to the results of their activities, there's a leading question. Why? To whom? What for? And the answer to that question is Krishna. Whether they get to that is another issue entirely separate. Same thing in jnana yoga. In jnana yoga, when there's attainment of samadhi, there's a connection with this Brahman, if you will, there is also a leading question at that point. Is that all there is? Because Prabhupada has mentioned, we do not stay in the, we desire personal relationships. So even when there is maturity and realization of Brahman, we think, is that all? Is there more? The answer to that is yes, there is more, and that more is Bhagavan or Krishna. That's my understanding. Let's have Dhammaratu Prabhu chime in. He has something he wants to say. He can surely explain this from his own realization.
Okay, thank you.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji, thank you for giving me a chance. It's not my realization, it's what Prabhupada has told us. So to simplify it, you know, the discussion can be very long, but to simplify, Prabhupada says there are three aspects or three levels of the Supreme Absolute Truth, which of course is Sri Krishna, which he divides into Satta, Chitta, and Satchitta Ananda. So these are the three levels, the Satchitta Ananda, which encompasses all the three, the Sat, the Chit, and the Anand, is Bhagavan Shri Krishna. So the Sat is the truth, which you very rightly said, the Jnanis or the people who follow the root of knowledge acquire, and that's the Sat feature or the truth. The Chitta is the consciousness which the yogis or the people who do meditation, they acquire. But to come to the complete realization, which is Sat, Chit, Anand, Anand meaning bliss, and that is the Krishna himself, you need bhakti, which is the highest form. So as very rightly you have been telling that the Ashtanga Yoga, the eight steps, are the steps to prepare one to go into higher forms of knowledge and meditation finally. But by these features, by these processes of Ashtanga Yoga, you can reach only up to the Paramatma feature, very rightly said by you, which is the Super Soul, which is the impersonal feature of the Krishna. It's not the complete Krishna, which is personal, which can interact with you very sweetly, which you can have pastimes with Krishna, interact with Krishna. But you cannot do it with Paramatma, which is the impersonal feature or the Super Soul. And definitely you cannot do it when you are at the level of the truth or the Satya, which the Jnanis do. So that is my understanding. I hope it helps in this discussion. Thank you very much for listening.
My I just have issue with having called the Paramatma realization impersonal, because, I mean, the Paramatma, he has a form. I mean, you can't interact with him so much, I guess, but, I mean, he at least has a form. It seems personal.
The way to describe this Paramatma feature or Super Soul, it permeates every atom and everything in this material creation, but you can't see it. So it is impersonal. You cannot see it, you cannot interact with it. You can just realize it, you know, in your heart. That's what the yogis try to do.
So it at least seems like a compromise, like a like a combination of both personal and impersonal.
Yeah, so thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still not that clear on this issue, but
which part?
The part of the effect or the role that bhakti plays in karma and jnana.
Hmm.
Yeah.
My understanding that the role bhakti plays in karma and jnana is that in order to, you can achieve, let's put it this way, you can achieve perfection in karma yoga without, I won't say without bhakti. I'm not going to comment on the bhakti because that gets a little, I'm going to say it like this. Krishna, you can progress along the path of karma yoga and succeed in being detached from the results of your activities and the activity itself, and in that way be perfected in karma yoga, but not have realization of Krishna.
Yeah, I agree with that, but okay. the part that I'm stumbling across is, you know, because I've always heard that, no, you cannot realize Krishna without, you know, bhakti, but you also cannot attain perfection in that karma yoga process without bhakti also. You know, some bhakti has to be there in order for your karma yoga practice to be perfected. And the same is true for jnana yoga, that some bhakti has to be there. Even though you don't have proper understanding of Krishna tattva, you know.
Right.
There still has to be some bhakti. It has to be touched with bhakti in both jnana and karma for those two paths to be perfected. You know, you certainly won't realize Krishna, you know,
right,
without bhakti. But you also won't attain perfection of that of those particular yogic practices without bhakti.
I don't know. I've learned something new every day. Thank you. I did not know that.
No, I'm just relaying what I've always heard for over so many years. You know, I'm just trying to reconcile what I've always heard with what I'm hearing you say today. I'm just trying to reconcile. Yeah.
Right. Well, one thing we do know, the term yoga does mean connecting with the Supreme. So the fact that it's called Karma Yoga and not Karma Kanda, or Jnana Yoga, not Jnana Kanda, means that we really are talking about connecting with the Supreme. So I guess from that angle, we can extrapolate that, yes, some tinge of bhakti is also in there somewhere. I just never heard it mentioned that way. I could not say one way or the other. So I'm curious. I'll actually do some research and study myself as well.
Yeah, I have to also go, you know, pursue this particular point to get something definitive.
Yeah. Sure, absolutely.
But I really appreciate your hanging there with me so long to get clarity on something.
Learning for me, too. I learn. Mm-hmm. It's a sharing. Mm-hmm. I learn as much as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should end there. It's, the day is beginning, and I do have to go to work. So, so I love our Tuesday mornings together. Thank you all very much for allowing me to share the apartment.
Thank you very much, Prabhuji. Very, very wonderful class and very nice discussion. So let's pay our obeisances to all the Krishna.